because we are out of time.
I thank you for contributing to this discussion and also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback, or some comments, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. You can also find us on various social media websites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
At least three Israelis were killed and several others injured in the city of Elat on Thursday in an operation the Palestinian resistance groups hailed as a victory for the residents of the occupied Al-Quds. The incident took place on the day of Nakba, or the Day of Catastrophe, marking the anniversary of Israel's eviction of Palestinians from their homeland and declaring its existence.
It was the event when 3/5, 40% of the Palestinian population was expelled or killed or expelled from their homeland, Palestine, and expelled mostly going abroad to neighboring countries and even distant countries.
The operation took place after over 600 Israeli settlers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound under protection from the regime's forces. Over a dozen Palestinians were injured, and some 50 others, including the elderly and children, were arrested during the raid. In a statement, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas stressed that the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds is a red line and that the Elad operation reflects the Palestinian nation's wrath over repeated Israeli desecrations of their holy sites. The Islamic Jihad resistance movement termed the desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli forces and extremist Jewish settlers a declaration of war against the entire Palestinian nation, stating that Palestinians will continue to confront the occupiers and their aggression. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan has practically turned into a period of escalating tensions between Israelis and Palestinians. Israeli forces raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque culminated in an 11-day war between the regime and Gaza-based resistance groups in May last year, a conflict that killed over 260 Palestinians, including scores of women and children. There has also been a recent surge in the number of Palestinian operations across the occupied territories over the past few weeks, raising fears that another war might be on the cards. The reactions to the mounting tensions have been particularly interesting. While many Western nations have kept silent about the developments, some, including US President Joe Biden, have been calling on both sides to avoid violence and exercise restraint. A parallel can be drawn with the war in Ukraine. Is anyone calling on Ukrainian troops to lay down their arms?
In a way, it's the same thing that is causing the United States to back the Ukrainians and to be against the Palestinians. The United States sees an advantage and putting pressure on a potential rival to its power, in this case Russia. They decided that Israel is the power that could help them to achieve that dominance. So it's all about in effect the United States ruling the world.
The normalization of ties between some Arab states and Israel has made matters even worse for the people of Palestine, despite earlier promises that the establishment of relations would benefit their cause. The Palestinians have vowed to continue their resistance until their legitimate rights are acknowledged. If the developments over the past several decades are any indication, they will make good on their words.
The United States is a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. That title means a lot of responsibility, as every permanent member is expected to remain committed to global security and collective council action. But the U.S. has shown for decades that it is very much ready to take unilateral measures to get what it wants. A case in point is America's sanctions policy. The U.S. has gone outside the U.N. Security Council mechanism to impose tough unilateral sanctions against many countries. Even close U.S. allies may become a target of American sanctions. This is the Harry S. Truman Building in Washington, D.C. It is the headquarters of the United States Department of State. Many major U.S. economic sanctions programs targeting countries around the world are devised and enforced by politicians, diplomats, and lawyers who work here. From coercion and threats to financial punishment, the team does everything to make sure the sanctions are enforced. Perhaps the harshest sanctions ever imposed by the U.S. have targeted Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, and the Russian Federation. America usually defends its sanctions policy, claiming that it is aimed at changing the behavior of foreign governments. but ordinary people in targeted countries have been bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The United States uses sanctions as a form of hybrid warfare. It is a form of warfare, it's economic warfare, and it's a modern-day version of siege warfare. So you can imagine that the United States, without committing troops on the ground, uses sanctions as a tool in its arsenal for regime change and for pressure campaigns, both politically, militarily, and economically, on countries that do not kowtow to it, do not bow to it, and do not follow Washington's policies.
In Iran, the sanctions have caused economic hardship for people, among other problems. Iranian cancer patients, for instance, have been hit hard by the adverse effects of sanctions. That is because many firms, financial institutions, and banks, which are vital in importing medicine, have been blacklisted by the U.S. State Department. Iran has been targeted by some of the harshest American sanctions in decades. Washington refused to give Tehran any relief, even at the height of the coronavirus pandemic, when all countries needed much more financial resources to battle the disease. Although Iran has many years of experience dealing with such economic restrictions, a considerable part of its problems are being blamed on them. They have put a lot of pressure on Iran's economy, causing its currency to lose value and pushing up its rate of inflation to unprecedented levels over the past years. Iran's UN envoy has called on the world body's Department of Global Communications to intensify its efforts to inform the international community about the adverse effects of sanctions on the targeted countries. Addressing a session of the UN's Committee on Information on Wednesday, Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations said the use of the coercive economic measures are contrary to international law, international humanitarian law, and the UN Charter. Majid Takht-Ravanchi noted that the sanctions have undermined economic growth in the target countries and prevent their access to basic medical equipment and materials by blocking their financial resources overseas.
People can't have access to proper medical supplies, food, different types of technologies that are necessary, for example, aviation. You can think of transportation, things like that. Raw materials that are necessary just for basic industry and production. And overall, you see that there is a massive pressure put on the population in terms of their economic power to purchase consumer products because of the sanctions that are imposed. So it puts tremendous pressure on civilian population.
Iran has in the past described American sanctions policy as economic terrorism. Tehran says the U.S. is addicted to such coercive tools. Despite criticism from around the world, the United States does not seem willing to change course anytime soon.
Outrage is rising in Spain over a hacking scandal. It has now emerged that more than 200 mobile phone numbers in the country have been hacked. The cell phones of the Spanish Prime Minister and Defense Minister were amongst the targeted numbers. Authorities have detected the Pegasus spyware in the mobile phones of Pedro Sanchez and Margarita Robles. Prime Minister Sanchez's mobile phone was breached twice in May 2021 and Defense Minister Robles's device was targeted once the following month. All in all, 2.6 gigabytes of information was obtained from the Spanish Prime Minister's phone during the first attack and 130 megabytes during the second, while 9 gigabytes were stolen from the Defense Minister. Spain's highest criminal court opened a probe into how the mobile phones of Sanchez and Robles were infected. Madrid has described the hacking as, quote, illicit and external attacks.
The illegal tapping of these phones has been proven in an ongoing verification that will reach all members of the government. We are reporting facts that are verified and reliable, not assumptions. These are extremely serious facts that confirm that intrusions have taken place in areas outside state institutions and outside the law.
The mobile number selections, believed to have been made by Morocco, occurred in 2019. Spain's socialist-led government is also under pressure to explain why devices belonging to dozens of people connected to the separatist movement in the northeastern Catalonia region were infected with Pegasus. The regional Catalan government has accused authorities in Madrid of spying on separatists.
So the Israeli Mossad has had a constant intelligence gathering operation against any client that is foolish enough to buy their materials. And this is being confirmed in the Spanish prime minister situation. So the CIA, the MI6, and the Mossad have always entertained a mutual intelligence sharing operation. And this revelation of the Spanish prime minister is just another example of that.
Pegasus is a malware developed by the Israeli technology and cyber arms company NSO Group. Unlike most spyware, Pegasus doesn't require its victims to unwittingly download it. Once installed, it allows NSO's clients to take control of a device to activate the camera and the microphone, see geolocation data, and read the content of messages. The company claims the spyware is used for counterterrorism purposes, but it's been accused of helping facilitate authoritarianism.
Well, the Israelis are notorious for the development of technology that they can sell to dictatorial regimes like Saudi Arabia, like the United States, like the United Kingdom, as well as others. But they always install a backdoor as well.
There are now serious concerns within the European Union about the spyware. In 2020, a target list of 50,000 phone numbers leaked out and analyzed by international media and rights groups revealed that the list contained the numbers of leading opposition politicians, human rights activists, journalists, lawyers, and other politicians. In France, President Emmanuel Macron is believed to have been on a list of potential Pegasus targets. And UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been warned that his office may have been targeted in 2020 and 2021. It's now emerged that the phone of Jamal Khashoggi's wife was also infected with the spyware. Khashoggi was a dissident Saudi journalist who was brutally murdered in Istanbul in 2018. The European Data Protection Supervisor, the European Authority on Data Protection, is already advocating for prohibiting the development and deployment of espionage programs with capabilities such as Pegasus.
I think what we're going to see is the revelation that the Israelis are spying on everyone with the blessing of the United States, and you're going to see a departure from their technology and countries seeking more solid, safe communication channels, such as that which is being offered by Russia, China, and India.
NSO Group has already been placed on the US blacklist. The decision reflects deep concern about the impact of spyware on US national security interests. An Israeli rights group has shed light on the regime's brutal behavior towards Palestinians. According to Hamoked, Israel is holding 604 detainees without charge or trial. Nearly all the detainees are Palestinian. The Israeli regime rarely uses administrative detention against Jews. The last time Israel held this many administrative detainees was in October 2016. Back then, the regime's illegal settlement expansion plan sparked a wave of anger and frustration amongst Palestinians. Administrative detainees are arrested on, quote, secret evidence. They are unaware of the accusations against them and are not allowed to defend themselves in court. The detainees are usually held for renewable six-month periods that often lead to years in detention. Israel claims the procedure allows authorities to hold suspects while continuing to gather evidence. But critics and rights groups say the system is widely abused and denies due process. Several Palestinians in administrative detention have gone on prolonged hunger strikes in protest, while many developing lifelong health issues. Administrative detainees and their lawyers have boycotted Israeli military court proceedings since the start of this year in protest and the courts are holding hearings without them. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years. According to Israeli rights groups, 2,441 Palestinians are currently serving sentences after being convicted in Israel's military courts. A further 1,478 detainees are being held for questioning, have been charged and are awaiting trial or are currently being tried. Last month, the Palestinian Prisoners Society, or the PPS, said the Israeli regime has detained more than 9,000 Palestinian children across the occupied territories over the past 7 years. Palestinian authorities say 1,500 Palestinian children were killed by Israeli forces during the time span beginning at the outbreak of the Second Intifada in September 2000 up to April 2013. That's the equivalent of one Palestinian child killed every 3 days for about 13 years.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's quite clear is that the so-called, you know, security domination of the Israeli occupation is very fragile. And in reality, the Palestinian resistance is exposing that on a daily basis. But that resistance is also taking place inside the prisons as well. Every single one of these over 600 Palestinians jailed without charge or trial under administrative detention are currently engaged in a collective boycott of the military courts to demand that this illegal system, an illegitimate system, come to an immediate end.
The Palestinian Prisoners Center for Studies, or the PCBS, said in a report in September last year that Israeli authorities had clearly escalated targeting Palestinian children. Systematic torture, harassment, and repression are all examples of the fashion in which the Israeli prison authorities treat Palestinian prisoners. The Israeli prison service keeps the prisoners under deplorable conditions, lacking proper hygienic standards. Human rights organizations say Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Geneva Convention. Israel has for years held Palestinians in overcrowded prisons with poor hygiene standards.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the necessity of doing goodness to parents. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the necessity of the goodness to the parents in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the verses of the Quran, or when we look at the narrations, we see that where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is talking about worshipping Him, He also refers to the respect of the parents and to do goodness to the parents. So these things, the being good and doing good to the parents, is attached with the worshipping of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the first thing that comes into our mind is that why Allah is referring to His worshipping and along with that respecting the parents or being good to the parents. Now, there is a connection, a deep connection, which is a logical and fitri, which is logical connection, and it is also something which is spiritual. Now, when we look at our relation with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we see that He is our Khaliq, He is our Creator. He has created us. He has given us the life. He has given us the existence that we have. So our existence is because of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He is the ultimate reason of us being existing, being in this world. So our existence is because of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Our life is because of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The blessings that we have, all these things are given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, logically it is said, intellect basically orders us to worship someone who has blessed you with all these things. And it is intellectually proved that we must be thankful or grateful to the one who does a favor to us. And since there are many favors that are given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, from the life that we have, the breath that we take or breathing that we are performing, walking, looking, and the sight that has been given. So all these things, they all are given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, logically and through the orders of the intellect, we must pray or worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of necessity of goodness to the parents. And we said that there is a close relation between worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and doing good to parents and doing ihsan to the parents and being good with the parents. And we said that because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us a lot of favors. Everything that we have, it is because of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, intellect orders us to worship Him. And it is our duty to worship someone who has given the favors to us, the life that we have. So there is a connection between the worshiping of Allah and respecting parents. And the connection is that Allah has made parents wasila, the mean of our existence. If our parents were not there, we wouldn't have any existence. Our existence is because of our parents. And on top of that, they nurtured us. They look after us. They spend their life, a part of their life, a portion of their life, serving us and giving us favors. For example, when the child was in the laps of the mother, she breastfeed her, and then obviously she provided her the sustenance that he needed or she needed, the baby. And obviously, on the other hand, the father has struggled. He has sent us to the school. He has paid our fees. If we were getting sick, he used to pay the fees for the, obviously, the doctor. And there are many, many things. I'm just giving some small examples in order to make things tangible. So basically, in other words, our parents, after Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, our parents were the one who nurtured us, who basically who look after us, and our growth is basically because of them and the favors that they have given us. Now it is time to pay back, and the way of paying back is to do good to your parents, no matter which age they are. Be good with them and respect your parents. That's what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants from us, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight. In the U.S., Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has said a national abortion ban could be possible if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Andrew Stanton. The piece is titled, "National Abortion Ban Possible If Roe v. Wade Overturned." Mitch McConnell. In the U.S. Senate, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has said a national abortion ban could be possible if the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. The future of abortion rights in the United States could be upended later on this year, as the U.S. Supreme Court could overturn the landmark case, Roe v. Wade, that guarantees the right to seek an abortion, according to a court opinion leaked by the website Politico earlier this week. If the court overturns the case, it would leave the issue of abortion to the states. In an interview with USA Today published on Saturday, 7th of May, however, Mitch McConnell, a Kentucky Republican, said on Thursday that a national ban on the procedure would be possible if the court overturns the case. If the leaked opinion became the final opinion, legislative bodies, not only at the state level but at the federal level, certainly could legislate in that area, Mitch McConnell said. He added, and if this were the final decision, that was the point that it should be resolved one way or another in the legislative process. So yeah, it's possible. Such legislation would face steep odds in the Senate, where the filibuster would require a minimum of 60 votes to pass a law banning abortion nationwide. It would be difficult, if not impossible, for Republicans to win enough votes to do so. However, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell shut down the idea of overturning the filibuster to pass the law. Mitch McConnell said, "No carve out of the filibuster, period." He told USA Today, "For any subject." Democrats would be unlikely to support a bill to ban abortion nationally, and some Republicans have spoken out against the idea as well. Missouri GOP Senator Josh Hawley said that he would not back a federal ban and that such a decision should be decided by individual states instead. It could also be met with resistance from many voters who largely support Roe v. Wade. A new opinion poll conducted by Yahoo News and YouGov, released on Saturday, 7th of May, showed that only 31% of the American public would support the court overturning the case. Meanwhile, 51% of the American public said they believe it should not be overturned. Many conservative states already have laws in place, known as trigger laws, that would ban abortions immediately or soon after if the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. Several of these laws were passed in recent years, as the balance of the court shifted to judges that Republicans believed would overturn the case. On the other hand, Democratic-led states, including New Jersey and Vermont, have codified abortion rights into state law, therefore guaranteeing abortion rights in those states. Democrats are also pushing to pass a federal law codifying abortion rights, but that bill would be unlikely to pass due to the filibuster. Meanwhile, reproductive rights advocates took to the streets in many U.S. cities up and down the country to protest the possible overturning of Roe v. Wade case, including in Boston, Massachusetts, on Saturday, 7th of May. Fewer than one-third of Americans say they support overturning Roe v. Wade, according to a poll conducted in the days after the Supreme Court's majority draft opinion to strike down the decision was leaked. The survey, completed by Yahoo News and YouGov between 3rd of May and 6th of May, shows that 31% of the American public back overturning the landmark abortion decision, while 51% of the American public say it shouldn't be overturned. Of those surveyed, 18% said they weren't sure. On Monday, The website Politico first reported on a leaked draft majority opinion written by Justice Samuel Alito, showing the Supreme Court had voted to jettison Roe v. Wade. If the case was no longer on the books, Center for Reproductive Rights, a group that supports the legal protection of abortion, estimates that 24 states would move to prohibit or severely restrict access to abortions. In 13 states, abortions would instantly become illegal.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. Recently, one of these American clones, that is John Bolton, said that they would celebrate Christmas in Iran. Such statements are made, but the gap between reality and what they say is really wide. Therefore, when you see that the Americans explicitly say that the maximum pressure policy against Iran suffered a humiliating defeat, this is a very great and important issue. That arrogant, proud, and overconfident U.S. acknowledges that the maximum pressure policy against Iran suffered a humiliating defeat is a very important issue. Therefore, my dear ones, we must not become arrogant, nor should we become passive or lose our morale. We should become neither proud nor passive. These were two recommendations that I wanted to offer. There are a few professional recommendations that I will discuss as well if it does not take long. One is about the slogan of the year, which was about production with two characteristics, being knowledge-based and being capable of creating employment. They criticized me saying that these two things are not compatible with one another. They are right. In certain cases, this holds true.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today,
and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The more advanced technology becomes, the less will be the need for manpower. Some people sent a message asking, will things be like this? My answer is yes. In certain cases, this is what happens. But this does not hold true for us because we have many factories which are either closed or half closed in downstream areas. Therefore, if companies become knowledge-based, these factories and companies will be positively affected as well. In other words, this will help increase job opportunities by several times. This is how it is. Therefore, we can create employment. Besides, new technologies have a natural tendency to expand. That is to say, the more we make progress in technological matters, the more available arenas we will have. So, creating employment will not be harmed, and making production knowledge-based can be worked on along with creating job opportunities.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
In the limelight.
Without any declared candidacy and with little spent on Republican candidates, the purpose of former US President Donald Trump's war chest remains opaque. We have prepared for you an article written by Edward Helmore. The piece is titled Questions Abound as Trump Raises and Hoards Huge Sums of 2024 Cash. Donald Trump's ferocious money-raising machine, powered in equal measure by grassroots giving and large individual and corporate donations, has never really stopped turning, and it is currently raising huge sums of cash. As of this month, Donald Trump has $108,046,100 saved in his Save America political fund, more than the Republican and Democratic National Committees combined, and 12 times as much as the fund PAC for the Future for the Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And all of that has been raised while Trump's own ambitions remain unclear. Though his grip on the Republican Party remains tight and he has waged an endorsement war against his opponents, the big question over whether Donald Trump will run again for the White House remains unanswered. Without any declared candidacy, his war chest purpose, and thus also that of its master, is unclear, and deliberately so. Donald Trump cannot easily spend the money on himself should he decide to run in 2024. Save America is registered as a leadership PAC, or political action committee, not a campaign tool for himself. According to its leadership purpose of supporting Republican candidates going into this year's hotly contested midterm elections, yet Trump is not spending much. Despite Donald Trump's more than 120 Republican endorsements, and even as Democrats pour money into their effort to retain control of Congress, the massive accumulation of cash under his control raises the question, what is it for? Donald Trump has not stopped raising money since he left office, either through thousands of small donations raised at Trump rallies or online, or via the big donor money machine that Democrats cannot match, being schmoozed by Trump himself on the golf course and in the dining room at Mar-a-Lago. Since Trump founded Save America in November of 2020, the group has raised $124 million. The largest war chest ever built by an ex-president, but spent only about $14 million, or around 11% of the fund. In contrast, the main fund for supporting Senate Republican candidates has spent about 80% of its $135 million it raised since the start of 2021, while its main fund for congressional candidates has spent half of the $162 million it has raised in the same period. The question of Trump's PAC money is beginning to vex strategists on both sides of the political divide. It could be a fund designed to ensure the loyalty of Republican allies forming a new power base within the party. Or he may have other designs, namely securing his own path forward by securing the political future of loyalists. The Democratic consultant Carly Cooperman said it's consistent with Trump's political priorities. Trump first, above everything else, and makes him well-positioned for a presidential run in 2024. Carly Cooperman added, it's possible he decides to make a big splash in competitive races as we get closer to the midterm elections. But above all, Trump's ability to raise large sums of money makes him even more powerful in the Republican Party. According to FEC financial disclosures, Save America spent more than $3 million on events through February, $2 million in consulting services, including to law firms representing witnesses sought by committee investigating the 6th of January Capitol riot, including the Trump aide, Dan Scavino, and Trump spokesperson, Taylor Borowicz. It also spent $300,000 on advertisements, $200,000 in contributions to Republican congressional candidates, and at least $170,000 at hotels owned by Donald Trump for lodging, meals, and the renting of hotel facilities. Taylor Borowicz, communications director for both Save America and Donald Trump, told Reuters news agency that the former president was supporting candidates through direct contributions, rallies, and joint fundraisers. In other words, efforts that bind candidates to the former president. Taylor Borowicz told Reuters news agency, Save America will not be telegraphing specific tactics or expenditures through the press. Every dollar raised will go to ensuring President Trump's America First agenda is advanced through his endorsed candidates and causes. Michael Beckel of Issue One, a nonpartisan group that advocates for campaign finance reform, says, there is a lot of leeway on how the funds are spent. While he remains an unofficial candidate, he can build his brand, draw further attention to himself by hosting large rallies, ostensibly to support other candidates in other states, but every rally has the upside of helping to boost his visibility and his brand. Donald Trump is certainly on the move, holding rallies across the United States with the usual aim of endorsing local supportive politicians. In some ways, it's a substitute for social media blackout. In another, it's Trump's connecting with his base in the way that has served him in the past. Recently, Donald Trump held a rally in South Carolina in support of Russell Fry, a state representative he endorsed to challenge the incumbent Republican Congressman Tom Rice. Russell Fry spoke briefly before handing the podium back to Trump, who continued for 20 minutes. Donald Trump teased, "In 2024, we are going to take back that beautiful White House. I wonder who will do that. I wonder." But the consequences from staying from Trump's agenda are also apparent. Recently, the former president withdrew his endorsement of Mo Brooks for going woke after the Alabama Senate candidate expressed doubt that the 2020 presidential election was a fraud. As Donald Trump withdrew his endorsement, he said, "Mo Brooks of Alabama made a horrible mistake recently when he went woke and stated," referring to the 2020 presidential election scam, "put that behind you, put that behind you." But Trump's enduring influence efforts are not limited to rallies or building his power base. Recently, the website Axios reported that Donald Trump Jr. is planning to launch a mobile news app after the bumpy launch of Truth Social, a Trump-aligned social media network that encourages an open, free, and honest global conversation without discriminating against political ideology. The aggregator site comes with high ambitions to compete with Apple and Google's new aggregators and to supplant the Drudge Report that has lost traffic and influence since founder Matt Drudge undercut the White House message on COVID deaths at the peak of the pandemic. A spokesman said that the news site, MXM, or Minute by Minute, will carry the tag mainstream news without the mainstream bias and would carry news from a variety of publishers across the ideological spectrum. With about 12 employees, an ideologically copacetic news site would be a useful tool, but it is still Trump's money that is the focus of interest when it comes to his future ambitions. Under election finance laws, should Donald Trump decide to run in 2024, he would have to start a new campaign fund. His previous PAC committee, Donald J. Trump for President, since renamed the Make America Great Again PAC, still has more than $6 million in it, after raising $13 million in 2021. Beckel explained, "The life of a political action committee after a candidate leaves office can morph to supporting other candidates. The bulk of the money Donald Trump has been raising is for Save America, but he also has a conduit vehicle, so a donor can write one check and it's split between buckets according to political contribution limits." Beckel added, "But how Donald Trump will spend the money remains an open question. He could shape the 2022 midterm elections or other future elections significantly if he decides to unleash it. One can predict from how other former presidents or politicians have spent their money, but Donald Trump is not a conventional politician."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
It was challenging to convince refugees at this camp in northern India to allow entry with a camera. Everyone was alarmed and started hiding their faces, while others emptied their shanties and some turned their backs. Rohingya refugees in India are in a desperate situation following renewed detention and deportation campaigns from the administration. Schools have already been detained while some deported. Intense crackdown on the community has created fear, which has led to sleepless nights amid worries of night raids and family separations. This old man, a little familiar with the local language, says, "I don't go out of the camp and prefer dying here than in a detention camp." Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are living in an appalling situation with little or no help from anyone. Even the UN Refugee Agency is watching as a silent spectator, they said. Their men were involved in menial work for survival. However, due to detention fear, they had no choice but to abandon work and stick together in their camps.
Finding this camp wasn't easy, and upon reaching here, panic and horror was visible on every face. They got terrified upon seeing us and rushed to hidings, saying media in India is portraying their image very negatively, and this has made their survival even harder.
According to rights activists, refugee crises across the world are alarming, but this particular community continues to be an unseen victim of immeasurable extents of violence. Based on official estimates, more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India after fleeing a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, a vicious hate campaign and their expulsion is haunting the community.
We appeal to the UN. We have no support. We need your help and the help from the Indian government to stay alive. We are in acute pain and distress. We reached here just with our lives intact. Please do not detain us, deport us, or separate us from families. Rather, kill us. We have no strength to face more.
Activists say the need of the hour is to protect the rights of these refugees and secure their survival rather than deliberately targeting them and deporting them, despite the fact their lives are under threat back in Myanmar. Rights activists have urged the Indian government to formulate a uniform refugee policy since the country has no refugee law. They urge the Indian government to treat refugees equally, regardless of caste, ethnicity or faith. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
NATO's hopes of securing two new additions to its military alliance are close to becoming reality as the historically neutral Nordic countries, Sweden and Finland, take serious steps towards applying for membership. The Scandinavian powers' interest in joining spiked after Russia's military operation in Ukraine began. Just the idea of a NATO expansion northwards has sparked a furious Russian response.
Both the US and NATO have made abundantly clear that they are very keen to see the two new Nordic additions to the bloc. However, with Sweden and Finland's long history of neutrality seeming to serve them very well until now, is joining the military alliance truly beneficial to their national and regional security?
NATO members, including the UK, US, France and Germany, have been applying pressure to secure the two additions. Moscow has repeatedly warned of serious consequences if Finland and Sweden join NATO, saying it would strengthen its land, naval and air forces in the Baltic Sea and even raise the possibility of deploying nuclear weapons in the area.
But what NATO is doing is to pull increasing numbers of countries within its orbit, either as direct members or as associate members, and that this then ties them to a whole number of things which they may not want to do in the future. The consequences of the end of this neutrality will not be more safety for any country in Eastern Europe. It will be an increase in the arms race on both sides. It will be an increase in military presence in those countries and elsewhere. So this is a road that people should think very, very carefully before they go down.
The coming days are crucial. Finland will decide to apply for membership by May the 12th, while Sweden, the less enthusiastic of the two, is conducting a security policy review, including the pros and cons of joining the alliance. The results are due on May the 13th. If both decide yes, the process of joining will be swift, but so too could Russia's response. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
Two Palestinians have carried out a retaliatory operation in the central Israeli city of Elad, where several casualties were reported. The operation came hours after Israeli forces attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque to make way for hundreds of settlers to enter the holy site in Al-Quds. Over a dozen Palestinians were injured and many more arrested in the raid on Thursday. The retaliation also coincides with the Nakba, the anniversary of the illegal creation of Israel. Palestinian resistance movements have praised the operation as a natural response to Israeli crimes.
Operation Elad is part of the public display of our people's anger at the invasion of our sanctuaries by the occupiers. Today's operation goes in line with the resistance's warning that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line.
We hailed the successful and heroic operation